From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Anyone's motives are complicated. The same for Edward Snowden, of course. And you can see the things in his life that moved him to leak thousands of highly classified documents from the National Security Agency to journalists in 2013. Snowden read a lot of Greek mythology when he was young. And he says hero stories gave him a framework for seeing the way the world worked. Video games, too, by the way, had an influence. Minor characters struggling against powerful forces. This is some of what we talked about with Edward Snowden on Saturday night in Park City in front of a live audience. We also discussed the possibilities and the limits of surveillance in the fight with terrorism. We're broadcasting that conversation today. Edward Snowden, after the news.
Hey, I'm Elaine Clark, one of the producers for Radio West, inviting you to check out Video West. It's our online showcase of short documentaries about the places and people that make Utah what it is. You can stream the films at videowest.kuer.org, and if you like what you see and hear, we hope you'll share it with your friends. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. No one disputes that Edward Snowden broke the law when in the spring of 2013 he traveled to Hong Kong with thousands of highly classified documents he had taken from the NSA, where he worked as a contractor. But was he justified in doing what he did? Could he have revealed this massive scope of government surveillance in another way? And what are the national security consequences of leaking those documents? Those questions are in dispute, of course, because Snowden set off a series of events that have changed the way we discuss that interplay between the right to privacy and the need to feel safe. Rather, you want him in prison or back at home living free, most everyone agrees we wouldn't be having this debate if we didn't now know what we know. Today, we're broadcasting our conversation with Edward Snowden, recorded live on stage at the Echol Center for the Performing Arts in Park City on Saturday. I should mention that Snowden joined us from Russia. That country has granted him asylum for the time being. He was with us by way of a piece of technology called a BeamPro telepresence robot. It's like a computer screen on wheels. I had heard Snowden read Greek mythology as a kid, so that's where we began. I asked him why.
Everybody remembers when they were a child, sort of, how they spent their time, what they remembered. For me, it was a shelf of books that was at my grandmother's house where I would sit on the floor and I would pull out collections of fables or myths. And I was particularly drawn to Greek myths. Children normally aren't confronted with the idea of tragedy. But almost every mythic figure, every sort of mythic tale, has some connection to that. And I think for me, it taught me at a very early age that life is a struggle. It's a beautiful thing. It's a collective thing. It's something that we build together. It's something that makes the world something to be cherished. But it's also transient, and that choices have costs, and that good things, they have to be strived for. As I sort of went through my development, as I sort of grew up in a federal family, my father worked for the military for 30 years. My grandfather was an admiral. My mother worked for the federal courts. And of course, I always presumed that I would work for the government. And eventually I did. Throughout my life, I've seen moments, I've been informed, where I see an individual at the point of that transformational event, where they have to make a choice. They have to make a difficult choice. And unfortunately, we've seen that our modern culture provides the most senior and influential members within our societies, the true elites, are increasingly tempted to make choices and decisions that benefit them or their class or sort of their tribe, and losing sight of the fact that we're all part of a common human family. It's not about whether you're a politician. It's not about whether you're a leader. It's not about whether you're American. When you decide something, it has a cost. And that applies for me as well, but I think constantly being aware of the fact that there is action and reaction that there's choice and consequence, is something that's guided me, and I hope we see increasingly guiding more and more people once again.
The importance of the internet to you as a young person, I know it was extremely important. You've described it as a crucial means of self-actualization for kids too, which allows them, you say, to explore who they are, who they want to be. And you put it this way, you said, basically the internet allowed me to experience and explore my full capacity as a human being. Now, tell me what you mean by that. And then also tell me, how is the surveillance state changing that?
There's a question in how we sort of draw our policies and how we live our lives that are made at a personal and individual level before they ever reach a community level. It used to be, hundreds of years ago, that if you wanted to start over, you simply had to move to the next village over. This opportunity to experiment safely, to try new things, today it's described as privacy. But traditionally, the word for it is liberty. What it means is the ability to sort of selectively share the parts of ourselves, our thoughts, in safe spaces, in new ways, to decide who we are and who we want to become. Now, for me, the internet was this mechanism. I, as a very young man, was in many ways a child of the internet. I was the first generation that really grew up with what we would call pervasive communications. We always had some way to communicate, not just in our homes, not just with our friends who were physically located around us, but the wider human body. And there's this counter-narrative that's growing in sort of traditionally powerful areas of society, where they say, look, 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 yes, there are benefits to our economy, to our culture, to our communications network, simply this global peace, to being able to understand everybody, to be able to draw connections, to be able to trade across borders. But it's a balance between what they say is privacy and security. But in reality, it's not really surveillance does not increase security. And privacy isn't necessarily contrary to what they're trying to imply, which is safety. It's about control versus freedom. It's about the level of openness in our societies. And that is what the internet left the largest impression on me about, is that you can have openness that reaches every corner of the world. And while it can be abused, as many other things can be, the benefits outweigh those costs.
I think by now people know the story of your upbringing. You just sort of referenced it there. Born into a military family and a family that worked for the federal government. Lived in North Carolina until you were, I think, 9, and then moved to Maryland. And then you joined the Army in 2004. Why?
So this was the period in which many, many people around the country and the world were protesting the Iraq War. And I did sign up for it. I believed that I had an obligation, a responsibility, to do what I could to help. The government was explaining its policies as an effort to free the oppressed. And I believed them. I sort of bought the explanations totally. I was naive. And many argue that I still am naive today. I don't see that as a weakness. I think being willing to trust, I think being willing to have faith, I think being willing to risk harm is how we're willing to risk greatness. And while when I joined the Army, I was very quickly disabused of sort of the public justification for it, many of those who I spoke to were much more excited about the idea of what they would call killing Arabs than they were about freeing the oppressed.
Ed, is that where it started then, the disillusionment?
Yeah, well, yes and no. I mean, for me, I didn't internalize it to that level.
Yeah.
I was actually injured, and that's what put me out there.
Right.
But I think it did sort of leave a mark. You know, when you think about cutting down a tree, if you're using a hatchet, it takes 1,000 strokes. That may have been one. But at the time, I don't think I realized it.
Yeah. As you said, there was a training accident. It seems like a really bad one, broke both of your legs, so you didn't end up staying in the military. But you did want to stay...
Right.
Engaged with the federal government. And this is you worked for the CIA for a time.
Right.
And I think people don't realize, when you were in Geneva, you were considered the top technical and cybersecurity expert in Switzerland. I mean, you weren't just a grunt. And I'm wondering, again, trying to get a sense of when this disillusionment starts to happen. So you are disappointed by some of the experiences in military training, but now in the CIA, was it here when you first started to become disappointed, disillusioned with how things work in the surveillance community and intelligence?
Well, again, the questions that you're asking presume that when someone's developing their ideology, when someone's coming to create their values, this is something that they're conscious of.
Yeah.
This is something that sort of is at the forefront of their mind. But in my experience, I felt this obligation of service. I had to help where I could. I joined the Army. I was in a special program for sort of the special forces recruits. You go through airborne training, you go through all of these difficult courses. And when my legs were broken, the doctor tells me, if you jump out of an airplane and land on these legs, they're going to turn into powder. Well, I simply have to find another way to serve. And I go to the CIA. And it's not that I see these things and they radically reshape my view. But again, I was exposed to things at the time that I recognized were immoral, that I recognized were wrong. But like many people in the intelligence community, I justified it. The way we explain mass surveillance at the working level, right? Because the people at the NSA, they're not villains. These aren't evil people. They're not trying to destroy Americans or shred the Constitution or anything like that. They honestly believe they're protecting the nation. They're keeping people safe. These are good people doing bad things for what they consider a just cause. These are people who subscribe to the kind of line of thinking that the ends justify the means. And at the time, I was very much the same. But, among sort of these books that I read when I was growing, there was one by Joseph Campbell called The Hero with 1,000 Faces.
Yeah.
The idea here is that, it's not there's a mythic other, a particular figure there who's set aside from the common person. There are heroic acts in every life. There are also villainous acts in the same. What separates sort of the greatest people from the worst people is, I think, simply developing an awareness over time of what it is that makes them an everyday hero, and moving it from these incidental moments of crisis, of trauma, where they recognized they had the ability to affect a change and did something about it, and beginning to expand that and seeing more and more step by step that when I see something wrong, not only do I recognize that there's something wrong, but that I don't need to wait for somebody else. I don't need to wait for a hero. I don't need to wait for an other, because the person that we're waiting for is me. For every person in every life, there's a path to self-realization, to self-actualization, to capability that at this period I was very much ignorant of. And I think that's continued. I don't think of myself as a hero. People use this language of, is he a hero, is he a traitor?
Yeah.
The honest answer is I'm an American. I'm no different from any other citizen. There is no value in the label. There is no values in the distinction, because that otherizes people. It separates them from us. But when I sat at that desk at the CIA and I saw terrible things happening, things which were not legal, which were not ethical, which were not moral, although they were in pursuit of sort of a reasonable goal, things that would support. I, like so many others, said the ends justify the means.
I want to see if I understand why you went to work for the NSA. You've said that you didn't want to leak CIA secrets, that people could get hurt. You said this. You said, I wasn't willing to harm people. But when you leak the NSA secrets, you only harm abusive systems. I was much more comfortable with that. So did you go to the NSA with the express intention of collecting documents and revealing them? Was that a plan?
No, I think I was describing sort of the mental calculus of how this works. How, you know, an individual sort of in my position views these breakdowns and these differences. When I went to the NSA, in the beginning, I didn't have the full visibility of everything that went on there, of course. I couldn't have planned to leak documents that I didn't know existed yet.
Right.
It wasn't until very late in my tenure there that I got the full picture. I came across a document that was stamped Stellar Wind, which is a special compartment. You can think of it as a classification that's above top secret. Well, by virtue of my position, I had what was called PrivAC, privileged access. You can think of this as a super clearance that sees across all compartments. And so eventually I came across this document marked Stellar Wind, which was the classified Inspector General's report investigating the abuses of the Bush era, in which they authorized the warrantless wiretapping of everyone in the United States of America and around the world, in violation of the Constitution, without even any specific statutory authorization, entirely in secret. And it continued for many years. A part of the program was eventually published in the New York Times in 2006.
Right.
And we presumed that that was the end of it. In the public, you know, Bush said he was disowning this part of the program, he was changing it, he was reforming it. They passed new legislation to sort of change things around the edges. But what I discovered in that Inspector General's report was that there was a whole nother part of the program which had never been made public and which had grown and expanded under new names, under new titles, and touched every life in the most invasive and unjustified way. And despite the fact that it was clear there were indications that the government was aware these programs were likely unconstitutional. Not only did they continue to operate it, they made intentional efforts to hide it from the review of open courts.
It's Edward Snowden. A conversation was recorded live from the Eccles Center for the Performing Arts in Park City on Saturday evening in an event sponsored by the Park City Institute. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're broadcasting our conversation with Edward Snowden, the former NSA contractor, who is living in exile in Russia. He joined us via satellite at the Eccles Center for the Performing Arts in Park City on Saturday night. We talked about his motives for leaking highly classified documents and why he believes surveillance does nothing to make us safer.
You said that what you wanted to do by releasing these documents was give people, here's how you put it, an understanding of how this massive surveillance system works so protections can be developed. So did you want people just to know in a broad sense how extensive the system was, or was it also important that you expose in detail the way it works?
You know, there's nothing in the documents that reveals the specific names of specific terrorists, human sources working behind enemy lines, anything like that, because I didn't want that to be public. I didn't think that would be in the public interest. But moreover, I never published a single document. I worked in concert with journalists. I revealed the material to them. They then were charged to make a public interest decision to say, look, the public needs to know about this and that. But of course, we don't need to know what every terrorist in the world is doing. So that will never be made public. Moreover, I required the journalists, in the case of every single story, to take their story, show it to the government in advance of publication, and give the government a chance to argue, maybe the journalists didn't understand something, maybe they went too far, maybe this one detail would be misunderstood and was damaging. And they did that in every case. And in no case has anything been revealed which has caused harm as a result. And I think that stands to basically support the argument that whether you say, you know, we need to know about this program or that program, it's 2015 now, not 2013. The director of the CIA, the NSA, the FBI, the DNI, the DIA have all testified before Congress. They've all been asked if they can show any incident where any individual has come to harm as a result, and in no case have they actually done so.
But Ed, I know you're well aware, 2014, the New York Times did not properly redact a slide in leaked documents, and information about how the U.S. was monitoring al-Qaeda in Mosul was revealed, and the name of an NSA agent was exposed.
So those are actually two different stories.
Right.
One of them about al-Qaeda in Mosul. Again, I didn't publish this. The New York Times published it.
But they published it because you released these documents. I'm not sure why you're saying it wasn't me who did it. It was journalists that you gave these documents to.
Public interest decision that this needed to be known. Now, what I will point out here is what they're referring to was a historic document. They were talking about a cell that had been destroyed many years ago and no longer existed. There were, of course, documents that were shared with journalists that revealed things that were not intended to be published in public. Now, this is not to say that it's irresponsible. This is not to say that it's dangerous. This is not to say that it causes harm. This is because if you share with journalists only specific documents that show the absolute worst things the NSA has ever done, they'll paint an unfair picture. They'll misrepresent the activities of the agency. You know, there'll be torches and pitchforks. They'll say, burn the agency down. They never do anything right. All they do is violate rights 24/7. It would be inappropriate. It would be unfair. And I would argue it would be contrary to the public interest, not for journalists to be able to see the real facts of how these programs actually work. Now, again,
but the New York Times
argue, hang on.
Go ahead.
You could argue that, the New York Times made a mistake here, or that I made a mistake in sharing this document, that it's this big problem. Even though the cell doesn't exist anymore, they were wiped away years ago. But the question is, who gets to make that decision? Should the government decide what the public knows within a society completely? They have total control of information. Or is that the job of the press? Now, I would argue that the First Amendment guaranteeing freedom of press in this country is first for a reason. The press exists to contest the government's control of information, to hold the government to account for the exercise of their powers. Now, there's one more point that you wanted to make there. You made a claim that sort of an NSA agent's name was revealed in a document. This is not sort of an NSA agent, which implies that somebody's, operating overseas undercover, that they're in some position of harm. This is an individual who works in Maryland. They're not a covert employee. They can list their resume online that they work at the NSA. If you go to LinkedIn.com right now and you type in National Security Agency, you'll see thousands of resumes out here. That was an individual who was named in that capacity. Now, the New York Times did say they named them as a mistake because they didn't redact things properly. But did it cause harm is the question. And I think it's completely clear that the answer is no, particularly because that individual has not come to harm.
Okay, but that raises the question, do you know enough about the documents that you've given to journalists to say there, in fact, isn't the possibility of a mistake like the New York Times made that would put someone's life in jeopardy?
Well, of course, but you're arguing something different here. You're saying, okay, is there any possibility where any harm could ever possibly occur in the pursuit of reporting these stories? Of course. Of course, if the press wanted to be a villain, of course, if somebody wanted to, you know, like if we've got a jihadist press in the United States, somebody could try to cause damage with this. But this is something that we accept within a free society. This is not evidence of weakness. This is evidence of the strength of our system. Now, critics will say, oh, there is some possibility, some edge case where some individual could be harmed because journalists go too far. What they want to do is they want to change the conversation. They want to talk about the theoretical risks of journalism in an open society instead of the concrete harms of their policies and programs. And we know from the NSA's own documents that they violated the law or their own policies at least 2,776 times in a single calendar year. Each one of those 2,776 times affected tens of thousands of lives. I think that's what we should be talking about, not whether or not in the United States we should have a free press.
Here's the criticism expressed by various intelligence officials, among them the current director of the CIA and his predecessor, James Woolsey. They say these documents that you released may have indirectly cost lives in the sense that they taught Islamic terrorists how to evade detection. Now, the recent attacks in Paris have raised questions. Everyone is wondering how it was those attacks were able to play out without the usual chatter that people hear. And so what people are saying and wondering is if the revelations that you made, in part, have helped these groups become more sophisticated. Now let me just, before you say that, I just want to get you to also respond to Woolsey's very candid statement made just recently. I think Snowden has blood on his hands from these killings in France. And later he said, and I should point this out, you should be hanged. So would you just, would you respond to that idea that by releasing this information, you've made the terrorists more sophisticated? You hear that argument.
Right, yeah. So thank you for asking. This is actually a good question because it is repeated a lot. A lot of people don't respond to it because it's clear that it's inaccurate. But first off, let's set Woolsey to the side for now because he says this kind of thing routinely about everybody who causes some embarrassment for the intelligence community. He's one of the individuals who is most responsible for the violation of American rights and the rights of individuals around the world. It stands to reason that he would do anything to shift blame. When we think about the Paris attacks, when we think about what's happened recently in San Bernardino, this is not evidence that sort of terrorists are now massive geniuses. They're encrypting all of their communications. Terrorists have long known that their communications are being surveilled. Osama bin Laden didn't stop using a cell phone in the last few years. He stopped using a cell phone in 1998. Bin Laden stopped using that phone because Bill Clinton fired a missile at his training camp. Terrorists that do not stop using electronic communications very quickly find themselves dead. But let's talk about, did terrorists specifically learn from these documents? So one of the very first documents that was revealed was about a program called PRISM. This is the one that the National Security Agency and these officials were actually the most upset about, because it revealed that they were violating the privacy of Americans and people around the world through some of the largest and most trusted companies in the United States, Google, Apple, Skype. Now, in the investigation since Paris, it's been revealed that Skype, which has a backdoor built into it to provide the FBI and the NSA access to terrorist communications, these individuals were communicating using Skype in 2015, when it was revealed in 2013 that this was not safe to do. It was also revealed that a cell phone recovered just blocks from the actual attack site at the Bataclan, I believe, was unencrypted. The police immediately looked at it. They had access to all the text messages on it. It showed that the individuals had planned and communicated regarding their attack via unencrypted text messages, which is the least secure method of communication. This is indication that terrorists obviously were not studying these documents very carefully. That's not to say, again, that they couldn't. But you're arguing here that something that does a global good could also cause some harm. But these are fundamentally public decisions. There is no circumstance in which these decisions can be made by a few officials behind closed doors. We don't need to know the names of every terrorist, target every person that's being tracked, but we do need to know the broad outlines of the policies and powers that are being both used in our name and against us. Because this nation is founded on the principle of the consent of the governed. And that consent is only meaningful if it is informed. Now, to make a final point about Paris, because this is really important, I haven't talked about this publicly because I don't think it's right to play politics at the cost of individuals' lives. And we see, you know, a number of officials that have gone out, and again, they're saying blood on their hands, they're saying we need to ban encryption, they're saying we need to remove the security from the smartphone in your pocket, even though you're probably not a terrorist, because maybe someday you could be. But the White House already reviewed these programs of mass surveillance, and they found that these programs never stopped a single terrorist attack. This program was operating in the United States. It did not stop the Boston Marathon bombing, despite the fact that actually the Russian intelligence services had given the FBI the specific name of the perpetrator that was involved in that attack. Paris, San Bernardino, this is the strongest evidence we have ever had that mass surveillance does not work. It does not save lives. Now, it does have value. These programs are excellent for gathering intelligence, but it doesn't stop terrorism. What it does do is it provides a significant advantage in economic espionage, in social control, and in diplomatic manipulation. The question is that whether we in a free and an open society believe that those capabilities are things that Americans should be doing. In the Cold War, in periods before, we said no. We distanced ourselves from systems of informants, of surveillance that crossed society that didn't discriminate between innocents and suspects. Why is that changing? Why did it happen in secret?
Edward Snowden speaking on Saturday night. He, of course, was in Russia. He's living there now in exile. He joined us by way of a piece of technology called a BeamPro telepresence robot. We'll take another break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the former NSA contractor Edward Snowden. We spoke with him on Saturday night at the Eccles Center for the Performing Arts in Park City, an event sponsored by the Park City Institute.
At least two big stories relevant to Utah, Edward Snowden, I want to ask you about. The first, obviously, the NSA data storage facility in Bluffdale. I've seen it reported that that facility sort of for you in some way was kind of a last straw.
No, I wouldn't think the Utah facility specifically was a last straw. It was more about the scope, the aggressiveness of the policies, the fact that they were founded, always founded on questionable legality. The government was aware of this, and it continued to conceal them, not because they thought the revelation would actually cause damage or cause harm, but because they thought if the public knew about it, it would cause what their own classified documents refer to as a damaging public debate. They were afraid of legal challenges. It did concern me what was happening in Utah, particularly simply because of the name of the facility. The facilities in Utah were called MDR-1, MDR-2, and I believe eventually they were going to create an MDR-3. Documents revealed that MDR stood for Massive Data Repository. Some forward-thinking government official thought, you know, it's probably not a good idea if we call it the Massive Data Repository. And they renamed it. Now, at least at the time I left, it was called the Mission Data Repository. But the purpose here is clear. The NSA's own slides repeatedly, when they're not speaking in public, when they're not trying to say, oh, these programs are fine, you don't understand them, they save lives, or some other way sort of shift focus, they say they have one goal. That is to intercept it all, to collect it all, to analyze it all, to exploit it all, and to know it all. This is a life cycle that they see as continuously moving in a circle. And while we want powerful foreign intelligence services, while we want the FBI to have strong investigative capabilities, the way to stop terrorism attacks, the way to save lives, is not to target a population, it's to target suspects. It's to go to a court to show probable cause that this individual is involved in some kind of serious wrongdoing. And in every recent terrorist case, we've seen this. Even in the case of San Bernardino, this individual was swearing bayat to al-Baghdadi, the leader of ISIS, on Facebook. You don't need to have warrantless access to be able to go to a judge and say, hey, look, this person just swore allegiance to ISIS on Facebook. Can we take a closer look at what they're doing?
Right.
I think it's fair to say that most federal judges would be comfortable signing that warrant.
Let me ask about... I wanted to ask about another story related to Utah, and this is the revelation that during the 2002 Salt Lake City Winter Olympics, the NSA worked with Quest Communications to monitor private email and text communications throughout the Salt Lake City area for like 6 months, I think it was. What do you know about this surveillance in Utah during the games? And I want to just note that this past summer, a class action lawsuit was filed by former Salt Lake Mayor Rocky Anderson, which argues that the federal government overstepped its bounds. You know much about that story, Edward Snowden?
So I try to make a habit of not reviewing things that have not already been published.
The Wall Street Journal reported on it, Edward Snowden. The Wall Street Journal has reported on it, others have.
Right, but they didn't necessarily go into what the extent of my personal knowledge of these operations are. They're working from documents. What I will say is that everywhere the Olympics goes, the largest and most intrusive surveillance capabilities in the world go. This is fairly traditional because they go, look, the Olympics is a big political target. We know, for example, back in Germany in the past, that it has been specifically targeted. They do need to be protected. At the same time, does this mean that we should have a constitution-free zone in a city in the United States for as long as the Olympics is there? I don't think that's necessary. And I do think that the government should not assert the executive privilege of state secrets doctrine. The government should actually be forthright, say what they did, say how they did it, say why they did it, and say what the results were. Only then will we be able to assess the value of these policies in an open, fair, and I would say ultimately American way.
If you were to distill all of this, what's the big question? I mean, I'm thinking, what are the proper bounds of secrecy? That's one that comes up. Another one related to it is, are we going to have to sacrifice some level of privacy for security? I mean, that's the question that comes up all the time. Do you have to accept some reasonable limitations in an era when you have an ISIS or when you have really aggressive terrorists? What's the big question?
I don't think it would be an improvement if we say, as long as the terrorists don't kill our Constitution, it's okay if we do. You know, one of the common arguments here is that this doesn't really concern me. I don't do anything wrong. I'm not a criminal. I'm not a terrorist. I don't care if they watch everything I do.
I don't have anything to hide.
Right. I've got nothing to hide. This is a fundamental misunderstanding of the issue, I think. Arguing that you don't care about privacy because you have nothing to hide is like saying that you don't care about freedom of speech because you have nothing to say. You know, the right that you lose for an instant is gone in all cases for all times. It's no longer really a right. It's a conditional privilege. And that the rights aren't granted by governments, right? The government doesn't give us freedom of speech. The government doesn't give us freedom of religion or the press or the right to be left alone, as the court so recently described it. They guarantee those rights that already exist inherent to us. But rights are also, and this is the most critical point, I think, not just individual, they're collective. If you say, well, I'm not using this right, so it doesn't really matter to me, you're saying, well, because I'm not a journalist, I don't really care if we have a free press. I don't care if we have the right to publication. You're giving a right away for everyone in every community, in every vulnerable space, because you don't see the value of it in that instant, in that moment. Rights are not intended for the majority. They're not intended for the powerful or the safe or the secure. They're intended for the minorities. Privacy is for the powerless. Transparency is for the powerful. That's why we call them public officials. And that's why we call ourselves private citizens.
It's interesting, along that line, there's this principle that's crucial for you. I know you've talked about this. In the end, we must enforce a principle whereby the only way the powerful may enjoy privacy is when it's the same kind shared by the ordinary. But right now you say this cannot happen unless science outpaces law, which is to say the technical community, you say, has to be willing to face the threat. So talk a little bit about, and there's a number of questions that we've got among from the audience. One of them is this question. What is the role of private companies in saying enough is enough and not being willing to cooperate and in being willing to sort of outpace, as you say, the law?
This is very challenging. Imagine a world in which tomorrow we get President Wonderful elected. We get wonderful elected to every seat in the Congress. Every perfect, most wonderful law you can imagine is passed. Every right is upheld. We operate in the most powerful and forthright manner. It's a glorious golden age. But that stops at our borders. And that's very much the case today in the context of rights in many places. Russia has some incredibly intrusive and repressive laws when it comes to regulation of the internet or speech. Increasingly, government officials feel comfortable telling people sort of who they can love and how, whether they can do it in public, whether they have to do it in private. And it's not just Russia. In the United Kingdom, the Prime Minister, David Cameron, said, in our society, should we allow conversations that the government isn't a part of? Well, anybody who believes in the four walls of a private home would say yes, but apparently the government of the United Kingdom believes no. Same thing in China, same thing in every other country. On the internet, which touches every life today, even if you don't have a smartphone in your pocket, even if you don't have a laptop on your desk, your banking records, your health records, your tax records. All of these things are moving across borders on the internet all of the time. And law can only protect in peripheral or partial areas within this border or that border. Science works differently. We can create, we have the capability now, we have the math, we have the technology to enforce human rights through new means, such as encryption, that will allow dissidents in China to have the same powers and protections for their communications that a journalist in the United States does. Now, the only way we will get there is if the public supports it. Academics continue to move forward here. The technological community works to make these capabilities accessible and easy to use. And critically, companies stand up for the right of consumers to enforce their rights through their technology. Companies today are facing extraordinary pressure in the United Kingdom, in France, and unfortunately, I hate to say it, in the United States, where people like the director of FBI are saying, we want you to compromise the security of your devices so that we have an investigative advantage. And that might sound compelling because you go, look, you know, we want police to be able to search smartphones. But central idea here in policy terms is if we in the United States begin leading the way in narrowing the rights that our citizens enjoy, what message does that send to the rest of the world? If we cripple our technological center of our economy, which is the envy of the world, and say that by law, American products can't be trusted, but Korean products can because they don't have backdoors built in, what are people going to buy? And what does this mean for the direction of the future of our society? I would argue that it is better for us to constantly be broadening the borders of the rights that we enjoy, both as individuals, broadly as a society, and ultimately as a united human family around the world, than it is to be standing on the other side of that line. And I do not foresee anything changing in the future. Any argument from any professional that would change that.
You know, it's interesting, during the Democratic debate last month between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, both believed you should come back to the United States and stand trial. But Sanders said that you had played an important role in educating the public. And I wanted to get your sense of what you make of that. Sanders said that you should receive some penalty, but that the good that you've done, his words, with these revelations should be taken into account in your sentencing. Would you be willing to agree to some kind of plea agreement if the U.S. attorneys agreed with Senator Sanders? Eric Holder, the former attorney general, suggested there could be a possibility of a plea deal. What are you thinking about in those terms these days?
I've actually volunteered to go to prison a number of times in the last several years in conversations with the Justice Department. I have also repeatedly asked to go to trial. The only guarantee that I've asked for is a fair and open trial. Unfortunately, they countered by saying, well, we guarantee we won't torture you. I actually have that in writing. They really did feel necessary to say that.
But if they charge you under the Espionage Act, isn't it true you won't get a jury trial?
Right.
Isn't it sure that there are extreme limits on the way you can defend yourself?
Right, so this is the argument, is that they won't guarantee that they'll provide access for me to directly make my case to the jury. Instead, they would want to separate me, for example, by a sort of audio communication systems where if they don't like what I'm saying, they can cut off what I'm saying so the jury doesn't hear it. They want to limit the kind of evidence that can be presented through something called like a Classified Information Protection Act. Basically, what they want to stack the cards. They want to have a show trial. And this is kind of extraordinary because this is not the kind of thing that we typically think of, that there is a fundamental unfairness running through the current system of justice in the United States. But increasingly, we're seeing politicians that violate the law in new or interesting ways, or even if they don't violate the law, they simply just break the rules in a way that if an ordinary citizen did it, they would suffer an extraordinary penalty. But if Hillary Clinton does it and starts passing classified information around in a private email, she doesn't get the Edward Snowden treatment. Now, you know, this is not to say that Hillary Clinton is the problem.
Very hopeful about the prospects of coming home, and that's what a lot of people are hoping for. You said early on you had accepted that your life is likely over because of these revelations. Are there no conditions you can see in which you would come home? Be able to come home?
Well, no. Again, I've actively volunteered for this. We're simply waiting on the government to call me back. But I'm actually more optimistic now than I was before. If you read sort of my immediate statements in the wake of sort of the Hong Kong period, they were not optimistic.
No.
But we've seen the tone change. In 2013, almost every member of Congress was saying, hang this guy off a tree, he's evil, he's costing lives, you know. In 2015, only James Woolsey says that. More than anything else, I'm encouraged by the power of technology, the changing of technology. Exile as a political strategy has worked for thousands of years. But tonight, although the FBI is probably not very excited about it, I'm not in Russia. I'm not on the internet. I'm in Utah.
You have said that you didn't want to change society. You wanted to give society a chance to determine if it could change itself. Here's what you said. All I wanted was for the public to be able to have a say in how they're governed. I saw a Pew report not so long ago that said 46% of Americans are either not very concerned or not at all concerned about government surveillance. I only have one fear in doing all of this. This is your quote. People will see these documents and shrug or say, we assumed this was happening and we don't care. I'll do all of this to my life for nothing. So how are you feeling about all of that?
I'm actually incredibly proud. Enough people care. And sometimes that's all that matters. You don't need 330 million Americans to agree on this, that, or the other. We are a country that was born from an outrageous act of treason, from a secret conspiracy, where the framers of our Constitution communicated via secret letters that were encrypted. If the King of England had had powers of mass surveillance, if he could break all encryption, he would have been able to completely shatter the revolution. He didn't. And 3% of Americans, as I understand it, I'm not sure, you'll have to fact check me on the number, 3% of Americans fought in the revolution. Only 30% of Americans supported the revolution. And yet we won. If 42% of Americans aren't very concerned, but 58% of Americans care enough that they are concerned, if courts have found these programs to be comprehensively unlawful, Orwellian, as they have described it, and this conversation, this debate that the disclosures of 2013 led to, have made us stronger, why wouldn't I be optimistic?
Let me ask you this finally. The core message for you is not so much about government surveillance, it's more about democratic participation. Is it true that you've said you're going to try and vote by mail?
Well, you know, I might actually be able to go to the embassy.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how the FBI's legal attaché, as they're called there, would respond to that, though. It remains to be seen.
It's Edward Snowden speaking on Saturday night at the Eccles Center for the Performing Arts in Park City. He joined us from Russia by way of a piece of technology called a BeamPro telepresence robot. The event was made possible by the Park City Institute. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Terry Orr and all the people at the Park City Institute. Thanks also to Jim Craig and his staff at the Eccles Center for the Performing Arts, including the sound engineer Max Selentrich. The conversation was recorded and mixed by our engineer, Lewis Downey. We have technical direction from Tim Slover. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.